Seltzer Kings podcasts.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
What does an 18-year veteran of the tech industry and a 20-year veteran of the military have in common? More than you might think. Welcome, everyone, to the Second Act podcast, leveling up your life's journey. Welcome back, everyone, to the Second Act with Michael and John. How are you doing this morning, John?
Hey, Michael, man. I am energized. I'm excited. I'm ready for today's podcast. It's going to be exciting. But, man, I'm good. You know, spring is in the air. The temperatures are starting to change. And I had a realization that, you know, a lot like the turn of years, you know, going in from an old year to a new year, January 1st, a lot of people have resolutions, but the same thing holds true. I think in the spring, people start feeling that warm weather and they're like, oh shoot, it's beach season. I got to get in shape. Or, oh man, it's about to be summertime and I've got my kids coming back to the house. I better figure out a plan for us to go on vacation. It's just a time where, you know, there's an excitement in the air and people are starting to move and get going and do things. And so I'm excited. I think I've said that now five times that I'm excited, but I am just ready and had some great conversations with people over the past couple of days about what they're doing for the summer and how they're, you know, getting things rejuvenated in their job, in their life, in their marriage. And I think this conversation today is going to be just more fuel for that fire.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. And towards the end of any winter season, you know, it starts to get a little down in the doldrums with the gray skies and nothing's blooming yet. But now as everything's coming to life again, I think it provides that inspiration. And then the motivation comes from having to put on a bathing suit at the beach and you want to, you know, look your best in whenever that happens. So, it's been an interesting time recently, especially the industry I come from, tech industry. I've had some friends and other folks reach out about just some changes going on in the industry at their company and just looking for some support and also for folks to be sounding boards, you know, and to provide any help that you can if they happen to be impacted by a restructuring or something like that. So I've just been staying in touch and really trying to be as much of a help as I can to those folks as they go through this transition period. And they ask sort of like, how should I be thinking about the world? And I'm like, take a pause and reflect and, you know, be intentional about what you want to do next. This is just an event in your long journey of life that you'll make it through. You know, everything is temporary in life. So good things lead to bad and bad lead to good.
Well, Michael, I'm excited about today's episode. Because today we are joined by Jacob Rupp, the CEO and founder of Business Lift, which is a company that helps coaches and consultants scale their practice fast from zero to 10,000 or more in less than 2 months. Jacob has also spent time as an executive coach, author, public speaker, and rabbi, but his life has not always been filled with boundless opportunities. He grew up in a single-parent household that lacked spiritual direction. He's got so much grit that he's on the show. He's physically ill and shaking if you're not watching on video. But he is willing to join us today to share his story. So, man, what a testament to who he is as a person and just his drive and passion. So, man, Jacob, thank you so much.
Anybody else, I would have canceled it. Anyone else, I would have canceled it.
No, I don't know about that. But
it's my pleasure. Your pleasure.
Man, we can't thank you enough for being on the show, and I know it's going to be incredibly valuable for everybody that's listening. you've been valuable in my life, you know, just a segue before we start getting into who you are. I connected with you about a year ago, and you took me from transitioning out of the Marine Corps and revealed some abilities that I could not see, and you made them apparent to me, and it helped me in my transition not only in, out of the Marine Corps, but into civilian life and into a new chapter. So this is really special episode for me to be able to talk to you and show other people just the power that you possess. So again, thanks for being on, man.
My honor. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
So Michael, why don't you kick us off? Let's figure out who Jacob is.
Let's do it. Let's go back to where life began, Jacob, as we tend to do on this show with our amazing guests, and what some of those important moments were for you growing up that helped create your sort of mental framework, where you wanted to go in life, the things you saw and were a part of that you're like, I want to leave, you know, some of that behind and change things for the better. So let's talk about some of that and start where you're most comfortable.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very excited to be here. I appreciate it, guys. I was born in San Francisco, California. It was very, it was definitely an interesting upbringing. I guess early influences was that we moved out of the city. I think when I was young, you know, the fact that like you grow up in a busy place, or just in New York, and it's just like a whole different energy, and things are going on all the time, and
yeah,
you know, it's just like a. It's funny. This will be our first reference. It talks about in the Bible that when Cain was exiled at the end after he killed his brother. So he said he was a city builder. God cursed him and he was going to be all by himself. And then said Cain was a man that built cities. So it's a very old principle that if you really want to be lonely and by yourself, go in a big city. And if you want to be a person that is rooted, so then, you know, go find yourself a plot of land in the country. So we did that when I was like five and moved out to a small, at that point, suburban like area called Concord, California, outside of San Francisco, as where I was raised. You know, some of the early influences, you know, that I think about when you kind of go back to my childhood were kind of like three pronged. You know, I always from the earliest memories, you know, suffered with like weight, like my weight, and sort of using food as a crutch. And then kind of this like unwinnable battle, which man, it was really, really tough because the more that you'd feel uncomfortable, the more you'd eat, the bigger you'd get. So that was like one area that I remember kind of like very, again, there's lots of highlights, I guess, when you think back some of the more critical things that you'd want to fix. There was also a clarity that I had from a young age. I think it was probably middle school, which I guess not so young, but I really wanted to make an impact. And I didn't grow up like terribly religious at all, but my grandparents would send videos or no, tapes back then to my mom. And it would be sermons from my grandparents' synagogue. And I never heard like a rabbi that was like inspirational before. Yeah. And that's probably like when you kind of like compare maybe, you know, kind of your local guy with like one of like the all-stars, you know, and you're just like, oh my gosh, like I didn't realize, you know. Right on the spot there, I knew nothing about Judaism. I'm like, I'm gonna be a rabbi. I didn't believe in God. I knew nothing. And so that was another like early influence. I found another kind of like major arc in my life is my parents' marriage was challenging to say the least. And, you know, my mom made the call to stay in it for many years to raise the kids, but it was very, you know, kind of a stressful situation. And my dad was gone a lot, and having kind of lost touch with him for 20 years, and I reconnect with him. And, you know, when people are in a very dark situation, they have a tendency to hide and to kind of go underground and to distract. So my dad wasn't really there, which is something that kind of scares me because, you know, I see parts of that myself with my kids. Yeah. When I was a sophomore in high school, my close friend, his dad kind of took both of us under his wing and started teaching us how to work out. And that was like my other big influence from that really stayed with me. Just remember like this like hot garage. It was like legit. It was like, you know, like rusty barbells and like, it was so legit. He would have, you know, 70s and 80s rock on, and it was like, It's like
Rocky style.
What's that?
Rocky style.
Exactly. Exactly. Like it was so hot. There was Black Widows like in the corners, dusty. And like, you know, that's where I learned about bench press, and that's where I learned about curls. And so like, I was always fat, but I was always big. And just how fitness can impact your life. I think at that point, also because it was really connected with this experience with someone, you know, caring about me and teaching me, I felt was very formative. So that's sort of like some three snapshots of my life that I think had a relatively significant impact down the road.
Very cool. You mentioned something about having a religious figure in your life who was able to deliver information in a way that inspired you. And I think a lot of times in our life, from childhood up until our last days on earth, it's when we come across people who have this amazing ability to deliver information, it can make or break the interaction, the connection, and the things that we do in life, for better or for worse. So, to all that said, it really comes down to many times in the way things are delivered. And that comes into play in sort of a corporate setting. I'm sure, John, you've seen it in a military setting. I'm sure, Jacob, you've seen it in the ways that you inspire and motivate folks and what you're doing. Because if it's flat, or if someone's just sort of like a negative Nelly, you know, it's going to pull you down. And then if it's inspiring and motivating and sort of joyous in how it's delivered, and you're pointing out sort of practical, interesting things, you know, people lean into that and they're like, oh, tell me more. So it's interesting to hear you share that feedback.
Yeah, I think that's something that people have to remember. Number one is that, you know, even the most fascinating stuff could be dry. So it's incumbent upon people to learn how to be effective communicators. And also, if people don't get the experience they want from something, don't necessarily think that the thing's not interesting. It could just be that the mechanism of delivery was not ideal.
Yeah.
So Jacob, when you moved out from San Francisco to Concord, was there still community? Were you still pretty involved? And how did that affect you in the aging process? Did you feel disconnected?
That's a great question. No, I think my mom was pretty good about arranging like social. I was always pretty social.
Okay.
Yeah, she was good. She was good at that, you know, and the value of community is pretty big. She had me doing sports and, you know, different, interesting sports, not like, you know, sports that I'd be proud of. I mean, I played soccer and baseball and I was like fat, so that didn't work as well. Baseball, I guess you could hit, but it really put me in like football or wrestling or fighting, like I would have been preferred to do. But it was more like I did ballet for a bunch of years. I did swimming. So it was, being a large man in a small suit was not ideal. But that being said, you know, they did create a sense of community. And then we had like our religious world that was also kind of a warm place where there was a lot of familiarity.
So you're in this small town. At what place did you decide to become a rabbi? A journey which you continued on for 15 years. How did you transition from one extreme to another?
You know, it's really funny because a lot of times when I do work with people, you know, Simon Sinek says the idea that you want to begin with the end in mind. And very often, you know, how to get there is usually evades us, but where we want to go, that we can start to figure out. So, you know, a lot of times I'll tell people like, I don't know how you're going to get to where you want to go, but like, what's the vision that you have? If you want to look a certain way, if you want to make a certain amount of money, like what, you know, and then start to do the things that you know you can do that accompany that, you know. So a lot of times people might work with me and they never hired like an expensive coach before, right? Something like that. And I'll be like, okay, well, you know, and I'll tell them about the prices, you know, that I recommend charging. And they'll be like, oh, I could never pay that. I'd never pay that. I'm like, okay, great. So let's not worry about how you're going to get there, but find one thing where you pay for quality over a bargain, over budget. And it was funny. I learned that from my car, which was like a very big, that was an intense lesson to learn because, you know, and the next guy showed up and he bought an $800 pair of shoes. And like, I wear sandals. Like, I would never buy it. But he did it for like, you know, whatever percentage less than I did. And then someone else bought a fancy pen for $80. I was like, but the point is like, you know, you have to get in the practice of seeing where you want to go.
Yeah.
And then doing little things that you think will lead there. So with the religious journey, you know, I didn't, and again, like I never saw myself being an Orthodox rabbi, and I can make distinctions. You know, the Reform and Orthodox Judaism, for the most part, are further apart than Orthodox Judaism and Christianity, Orthodox Judaism and Islam. So it's
really
a very, very dramatic, departure. And so, you know, the idea that I would take that path, I kind of knew where I wanted to go. I didn't know what it was going to look like. I had no idea about that. And then it changed a lot, you know, but if you kind of stay true to the objective at the end, remember the famous line from Saving Private Ryan, where they were going to go like storm a machine gun nest. And they said, you know, we don't have to do this. It's not, you know, a part of the plan. And Tom Hanks was like, well, what's our objective? And they're like, we got to go get Private Ryan. He's like, no, our objective is to win the war. So he chunked up big enough. So, you know, they ended up, I forgot who they lost. They lost the, not some medic. That was like Vin Diesel's first role or something like that. No, he got shot by a sniper, whatever it was. So the point is, you know, that as long as you keep the perspective, the big picture where you want to go, I found that most people get there. The same is actually true with money. You know, I have a client still who, you know, his kids are, have, you know, 15 rental properties. Like they're, you know, it's like, they're good. And they're like four, you know, 4 and 3. You know, so he's doing very well, but, you know, we had this conversation around no matter what he's built, he feels not successful. And so he goes to work, you know, he goes to the private school. He sends his kids to, he's actually in Colorado. And not that, whatever, but he goes to Colorado and he says, I look out, you know, I see, you know, all the dads have the Teslas and the Porsches and the, you know, whatever. And they're all these successful guys. And, you know, I said, well, what would happen when, what kind of car do you want? He's like, I mean, you know, I would get a Tesla, you know, but and I'm like, okay. And then further down the road, turns out that they don't have cleaning help. And I was like, and his wife's like working full time also. And I was like, what is going on? Like, you know, and just kind of flushing out from him how we have very strange definitions of what success and wealth looks like. And so some of us might think, you know, if my kid has enough to, you know, never have to work, like that's success. For me, it was always around carbs. And I don't know why. I could probably figure it out because my dad was really into cars. That's what it was. And, you know, so I remember when I was young, you know, driving around the Ferrari dealerships in San Francisco and I was like in high school and, being broke for all those years. But at the end of the day, the thing that I got was like the car.
It's great. I mean, I think the aspects of community in your life, that were very supportive in the direction you wanted to go in, maybe had an influence on you becoming a rabbi and helping connect with that community. And it's funny you bring up the definition of success. We talk about that quite a bit because I think when you're young, there's a lot of the things, the material things that we think of as success. And I've heard people as they mature and then get, you know, much older in life, they look back and like, yeah, those things were good. But actually success is, I think in the example you used actually, is being able to get some of my time back for the important people in my life. So getting someone to help clean or cook or do whatever it is so that I have more time after working really hard to spend with my friends and family and loved ones and the community that I've built.
Yeah, it's just a very proactive process where if you think about it, you can actually build whatever you want. Just, you know, most people don't, like I didn't think about it, you know, and I find, you know, because a lot of people I've worked with will generate a lot of money quickly. And I was actually talking to a client yesterday about this and, you know, she has this fear. She's already been a very successful coach and she has this fear of like what a $40,000 month looks like. And she said, I just had this fear over and over again. And I said, she also had a cool story. She looks like, her husband's a Navy commander and her, and she like, he's awesome. But, and he was going to join my program, but then I saw her and like she's like, looks like pro level IFBB type of like we're not messing around. Like she's serious. And I was saying to her, you know, like I said, you know, but she was also like pictures of her in high school. She was also like super fat. And, you know, she was saying, I was sharing with her that part of there has to be an identity shift. Right. And so just like the way that she was able to put on the weight and have her kids and then go back to the way she wanted to look was because she was a fit woman that was having kids. And the reason why a lot of people never lose the weight or they're up and down, of which I've done that many times, is because in my head, I'm still a fat guy. So it's like, how do you change that definition? What is success? Is it time with my kids? Is it time to be creative? Is it financial freedom? Is it even in a marriage? Like what are the values that we have? You know, there's certain people that are in it forever. There are other people that are in it as long as it works. Like, but a lot of times we use the same words, but we don't have actually clarity around what it means. And so being able to have the clarity around the actual things is like very important.
Yeah. 100%.
You know, listening to you talk about triggers and clarity, right? And then the shift. I remember a post from you a couple months back, maybe 6 months ago, that you were talking about how you used to work, maybe it was a summer job or a part-time job where you were helping move or you were doing...
Garbage man.
Trash truck. Yeah. And you were carrying this pea-soaked mattress, right? It just reeks. And oof. And you're like, that right there made you shift. That idea of, I never wanted to have to do this ever again, made you shift and realize what you truly wanted. Explain that situation.
Well, you know, I think that a lot of times life kind of works like driving through fog. And the fact that, like, you don't know, you know, again, I have a dear friend who talks about brilliance in the basics, but that for the audience is John, who I use all the time. But, you know, we sort of know where we want to go, but life appears pretty foggy. And what are our control? Like, what are things we can control?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like, I can get really good at the things I'm doing right now. I could take the next few steps, and then I can just sort of have faith that I'll get there. And again, that's also biblical in that God told Abraham where he was going. And it talks about that being a big test of his. So it's like, if I'm telling you, you're going to go to, you know, whatever, Columbus, like, why is that a test? It's like, well, he didn't tell him how he was going to get there. And so someone like Abraham, who by nature is a visionary, who by nature is a leader, again, like, you know, I'm not going to act tough like I'm in the military, but theoretically speaking, I'm assuming if you go on a mission, you plan it out, and you plan out, yeah, like 50 different contingencies, or like 30, or like 500 different contingencies. But no one's like, I don't know what's going to happen,
yeah,
right? But that's the kind of framework that we need, is to sometimes recognize that I won't have all of the answers. And again, I think, John, you'll maybe verify this as well. It's like, at the end of the day, it will fall back to your training, because you might have a scenario that nobody saw coming. And at the end of the day, like, that's when the training kicks in.
Well, you know, it's, we joke around about Mike Tyson's quote, right? You never, you know, everybody's got a plan until you get hit in the face. Well, the alternate is true as well. In the military, we try to come up with the idea that we're going to get hit in the face. We're going to have opposition. As soon as you take off, as soon as you step off from the line of embarkation, as soon as you cross into enemy territory, what is the first thing that's going to happen? What are the secondary, third, you know, and what are those stumbling blocks that you're going to hit that we try to plan for? Now, not every scenario can be planned for. And if we had to plan for every scenario, we would never take off. We'd never start marching. We'd never, you know, move towards the objective. So you have to have some sort of plan. You have to have some sort of idea. But you also have to be comfortable that your plan is good enough to start. And that's one thing, yeah, that you and I worked with, you know, when we were first meeting, was I said, you know, Jacob, I've been doing this military thing for 20 years. I have no idea what I'm doing outside of that. And you're like, well, but you got a good idea. And you know enough to just start. And then that's what Michael and I talk about now, is with people, moving into second transition, into second jobs, in transitioning into something else, or moving from corporate world to entrepreneurship, the biggest thing that people get impelled by is the unknown, or not, yeah, knowing everything. And sometimes that biggest learning curve is just taking that first step.
How do you help people, Michael?
You know, we've talked about it in some of our earlier episodes, on at least through this show, my own mindset when it comes to that stuff. And I think you have a goal, like you said, Jacob, or some vision of where you want to be in the future, and you stay resolute towards that, but be flexible on the details in terms of how you get there. And I think you have to make the commitment mentally to commit and go, and just go. And understand that things are going to change over time, and it's not going to be all smooth sailing. And having that mindset, and not trying to boil the ocean in that process. So I think a lot of people get caught up on trying to do all the things to get to that vision right away, instead, yeah, of incrementally, as we've talked about, John, getting 1% better every day, and the magnificent compound effects of doing that, even though it seems, yep, so inconsequential in that moment, in that day, in that time. Those little things build on top of each other, and I'm shocked at how far, you know, we've been able to come, and we're sitting here with Jacob having this amazing conversation. It's just it's been, yeah, a fun journey.
It's funny, because I think also you have to work on the idea of getting around the people that have actually done what you want, and like learning from them, you know. And then there's the people that, so I talked to a client about this today. He's saying, you know, he's got someone who's like advising someone else in his company, and the guy's like never done anything, and he's having, it's so frustrating. And it's interesting, if you look at people who are truly exceptional, and again, the business world, the sports world, you know, their identity is hooked to the work that they do. I was like Michael Jordan, how he explained it, how Kobe explained it, you know, how, I mean, this one, the same guy from Colorado, it's funny, like he gets two shout outs. He told me that we were thinking about, you know, what's the strategy for his, you know, his growth. And I recommend it. Can you talk to people that have achieved kind of the next ring or two up the ladder that you have? Because my client was saying, like, you know, I basically exhausted all of the assets, all of the strategies to keep my assets safe. And then he met these two guys and he said, both of them have gone broke twice. And I was like, interesting. So sometimes if you talk to people who actually have achieved what you want, they're going to realize you go broke a couple times on the process of building your journey. You know, I mean, Bezos was like that also. He never, his whole company was broke for like 20 years, but like, it was that mentality of like, I'll figure something else out, but he was totally ready to fail. And so, you know, I think it's, we have to change the identity to, I'm willing I watch a lot of UFC and it's like, you watch those guys, they're just willing to die. And it's like, I will not stop. I'll keep going. And then, you know, I'll either die or I'll win or I'll lose. It doesn't matter, but I'm going. And so that identity over, I'm the champion and I don't want to lose. And so that's kind of where you see, fighting is so cool because you really see like the rawest of like human experience, but it's very, very true.
And the media glorifies the wins. They'll write the articles about the success stories and the wins and the overnight successes, but there's 1,000 dead bodies behind that win of everybody who has tried things in various different ways. And really in your first or second chapter, whatever that is, you're paying for an education essentially, and maybe it worked out and maybe it doesn't, but you're learning by doing. And I think that's, you know, what we've all done here in our second, third or fourth acts, whatever it may be. So awesome, awesome points, Jacob.
Thank you. There's a book that just came out called The Second Mountain by David Brooks. And he speaks about that. He says that, you know, the first mountain that we climb is like what we thought we were going to do. And then, you know, the time comes where we get knocked. Some people live on that mountain their whole life. They, you know, married the girl from high school, have the kids, the white picket fence, have the job, get the watch, die. And he says other people, you know, there's a death in the family, there's health problems, there's divorce, there's, you know, you lose your job, your company goes broke, whatever it might be. And then you go to the second mountain and you go through this dark, dark time. And some people don't get out of it. And the second mountain, he says, is much more, it's raw, it's authentic. Those are people we can talk to. They're community oriented because they know like what it's like to be in the valley. And I think it's a very interesting idea that, you know, just that, and that was the whole idea, you know, that, you know, after Adam and Eve like sinned, you know, they, on Friday night, Jews will light a multi-wick candle. And as part of the ceremony that leaves the Sabbath, and the sages explain that the reason why is because on the evening of like Saturday night when the Sabbath is over, that's when Adam discovered fire. And so whatever long roundabout thing is basically prior to Adam's sin, the world was always light. Then when he sinned, it got dark and he thought it was going to be dark forever. And the concept was as you move out of that first period, God showed him fire. And he realized that even in the darkness, he can make light. And so we have that framework of no matter what we're going to go through, we have the capacity to generate the next step.
Jacob, I want to go back because, you know, you're obviously very influenced by your times as a rabbi. You spent 15 years in that community, and I know the Jewish community is very tight, very loyal. But how did that time, specifically as a rabbi, lead you to become now an entrepreneur?
So I have a problem that I have a problem that I really have a hard time fitting in a box.
Okay.
It's very hard for me. And it's been, you know, it shows up in a lot of ways, you know, meaning that, you know, the way that someone usually achieves greatness in one area is soul focus. And what I always wanted to do was to achieve greatness in multiple areas. And I never really found someone that did it. Now, what I have a problem with is when I meet someone that I want, and I'm trying to always find a master, I'm always trying to find a coach, I'm always trying to find, and I'll get super close to people, and then I'll be like, oh shit, actually, sorry, I cursed. at the end of the day, like, you actually don't have that part figured out the way I want you to. So again, for me, the spirituality piece was huge, but it never solved the money problem.
Yeah.
And it also didn't solve the freedom problem for me. Okay. And I ended up, and there's a great book called The Big Leap by a guy named Gay Hendricks. He talks about how you have a zone of greatness, of excellence, the zone of excellence, and you have a zone of genius. And he says that the zone of excellence is what everyone wants you to keep doing because you're really good at it. But he said for most people, that's going to kill them. And they're just really, really good and really, really good, and they die being really, really good. And the zone of genius is like when you don't know what the hell you're doing. All the things we talked about, like, you're holding on by your fingertips, and you're just like, what in God's name? I met a guy, actually, I was a client of mine from a long time ago. He's probably, I would say mid to upper 40s. And he had built and scaled probably like 3 or 4 companies. And he found himself raising capital and being in a room with all these men, white men with suits, he said. He's also white and probably was wearing a suit, but for some reason it was white men in suits. And he was like, oh God, they're going to find out. Like, I'm just like, I was a garage, you know, a startup garage, you know, type of entrepreneur guy. And he never really like matured out of that. So it's just interesting to get back to what you're asking is like the rabbi thing worked really well for a really long time. I was making more money than I ever had made in my life. I was 23 years old. I was in a rent controlled apartment in LA that was really nice. I was doing incredibly meaningful work. And I was good at what I did. And so I never got better. I didn't learn how to fundraise because I didn't want to ask people for money because I didn't know how to associate value, like fit financial value with what I was doing. Yeah. I didn't think about my next step. And what was awesome when I was like 23 or 24, you know, living on frat row with my wife and at that point, like one or two kids, you know, when you're driving an hour and a half to get to Hancock Park in Los Angeles, which, you know, with the traffic, and you're up all night because of the frat parties, and the 100 grand when you were 23 is not what it used to be when you send 4 kids to private school in Los Angeles and the preschools, you know, 40 grand. You know, the writing was kind of on the wall, but
yeah,
you know, you stay in it too long sometimes. And that's where the bitterness starts to happen. So that was it. And it was interesting in the process, I generated a lot of negativity. I generated a lot of negativity towards my religion. I did because I figured, why would God, I was so good. Like, why would God do this to me? It really wreaked havoc on my marriage. I think it really created a very big distance with my kids and with me. And I found myself like just not knowing what I wanted to do. And that launched me on like a, I don't know, I think I was happy as a rabbi for 6 years. So if that gives you any indication of like my midlife crisis, wow, at like 30, you know. So that was it. So usually what I found is there's kind of two types of people, and I happen to be the kind of person that will hold on to something until it's untenable. And unfortunately, I usually let someone else tell me that I've held on too long. And so I was negotiating with my employers, and they were like, you know what? I don't think this is a good fit anymore. And I was like, oh my God, like you've just fired Babe Ruth. Like, do you understand that? And they were like, we'll find somebody else. And I was like, okay. And then I went home and cried like a baby, and that was the next 7 years. So, I think it did in a lot of ways. It soured me from the process, but I think I'm incredibly grateful because even though like I became someone that in a lot of ways I can't recognize, because again, if I'm an Orthodox rabbi, like, you don't look like this. And it's really confusing for my kids because why is Dad, you know, wearing shorts and everyone else is wearing a suit? And it's not just the superficial stuff. It's also the, you know, I don't know. I have a pretty, I think a lot, I, you know, everyone in the Jewish world, people are the nicest cars people drive are like, you know, a Volvo S80. I know a guy, you know, like 500, well, he has, but I knew a guy, massive metal company, old man, S80, brand new, awesome. That was the, you know, the best car. I'm driving like a, you know, convertible Porsche Turbo. And one of my mentors was like, hey, where do you park that at the synagogue? And I was like, oh, right in front. Why? He's like, wow, the first time I bought a Porsche, I left it at home and walked because I was so ashamed to have actually bought that car. So yeah, there was a lot there.
Yeah.
I think the point of that was though, that the reason why I park it in front is because if I could do it, literally anyone can. I don't see what I did as anything special. It was just a matter of divine grace and just work. That's it. And luck.
Yeah.
I love what you said a minute ago about holding on too long and kind of souring in the place that you're at. We talked to a lot of people who have done a lot of interesting things and then moved on to more interesting things. And we talk about, you know, about getting long in the tooth or just being in that job, but I've never heard it said that way. And I think that's so true with people is they give up their dreams for the comfort and the situation they're in currently. So they start out, they buy the cars, they buy the houses, they buy the things, they set up their life in a job or an occupation that they're not fully in love with. And they get to a place where it's so unnatural, feels so unnatural, feels scary to get out of that because, well, what if I can't afford all these things? Or what if I can't keep up with, you know, this lifestyle? And something has to give, right? They either have to get out to pursue happiness or they stay in, they sour, and they keep doing the job that they're not really excited about because they built this wall around them. So that's an interesting concept that you've kind of created for me. So I appreciate that.
I mean, I love that. I'd say one other thing is like, it's really funny. The most successful, there's one guy in mind that had, he's such an awesome dude. He runs a massive probably $1 billion real estate company in California. And young guy, probably, I don't think he's 42. And so I learned a lot from him. And which I think was the secret to my success as a coach was I always worked with people that I was always much more impressed by than they were impressed with me. So I didn't like show up and try to like tell them what to do. I was always like, wow, how do you think about that? And they're like, told me. And then they're like, oh shit, that's how I solved the other problem. I was like, yeah, that could be. They're like, cool. So, but one of the things I learned from him was, you know, I worked with a bunch of these guys like right around COVID and, you know, kind of looking, he does a lot of like rental, you know, rental properties in around California, Arizona. And, you know, it was bad. And he's like, the other day, I'm totally good going back to my apartment. I don't give it. He's like, I'm good. And I think that was something that I learned a lot about, which is like, you know, like one time when I had my BMW, like it had like engine problems and they gave me a rental like Hyundai. And I was literally like walking out of the car at like Trader Joe's being like, I'm sorry, this isn't actually my car. I'm actually a very successful man. Like you should know, like this isn't my car. This is my, yeah. So I noticed at that point, like, wow, you're buying into your own stuff. You know, but at the end of the day, what I started to do was I'm cleanly, like I wash my car a bunch, you know, but I have like some close friends that I like, and my kids also, like, I like them to get the stuff dirty. So it's like, you know, it's that feeling of like, get this stuff that makes you feel the part, but don't take it so seriously and don't be willing to lose all of it.
Yeah. And coming back to what you said, John, I think you have, especially with something new and you're just starting out and you don't have much to start with, you're driven by passion and sort of that bigger goal around what you think success is going to be. And as you go through that and you get comfortable with the familiar and you get settled into all the things and you do that for a period of time, you can get to the point where you've lost some of that passion and you're not able to reinvent yourself in ways that are exciting to you. And that's where you're putting on at some point, maybe a facade. Like you have to either, you have a team or, you know, with your family, or you're in a position where you're having to communicate with others a lot about work and what you do. But it's not real. And you need to step away. I was watching this interview recently where they were talking about music artists and they go into it, you know, not having a care in the world. They just want to make the best art, best music possible. And it's all driven by passion and life experiences and things. And then once they get in the game, they're chasing the charts and they need to get the next platinum album and all these sorts of things. And it starts to become very commercial oriented and it diminishes some of the passion and creativity that they get through that process. And they actually have to step away. They maybe haven't lost interest in creating art, but the situation or the system has soured their view, maybe temporarily, on what's going on. They step away, and it could be for years in some cases, and they find that fire again to do something else or come back to the art.
I was just going to say two things. You know, Jordan Peterson talks about how more than people have stories, stories have people. So a lot of times, like movies will capture things about life that I could tell you it, but I can show you the movie and you're like, oh yeah. And it was fascinating. There was a, I watched a few movies like on repeat when I was younger, and I didn't think about, you know, that being influential, but they're all violent. Like it was like Saving Private Ryan, Pulp Fiction, Any Given Sunday, Gladiator, Braveheart. Those are kind of like my core. Yeah, American History X, of course. Like all, I've got those like memorized like back of my head. So much so that I'm not awesome that I have tattoos, but someone, my wife would ask me like, what kind of tattoos do you get? I was like, oh, I get these like two like Rottweilers with blood coming out of their mouth on their backs. She's like, where'd you get that from? I was like, oh, that was what he had in American History X. She's like, that guy's a white supremacist. I was like, it looked awesome. She's like, what is wrong with you? Anyway, you know, it's interesting. There was a scene in Any Given Sunday where Jim Brown and Al Pacino are sitting in a bar, and you know, they had just lost, and Al Pacino's on the down slope of his life. He said, "I'm just going to go back and coach high school football." You know, after I get out of the NFL, because he said like that's where it's pure, and the kids, you know, the kids are like real, and that really spoke to me in a very deep way. And speaking about some of the things, I mean, again, I focus on the negative, not because there's not a lot of positive, but I think the negative actually gives you like learning lessons. And I think about a lot of times, like my own religious journey when I became, you know, from what you would call like a normal kid to a ultra white right wing Orthodox Jew, you know, and all the things that means, which for your listeners means basically like every single step of your life is dictated, which shoe you put on first, which lace you tie, how you, which way you go to the bathroom, what you eat. You think it's serious. I'm not kidding. And one of the things, and so I'm interesting, like an 18-year-old kid, like what really spoke to me about that? That's one question. But then also I did it successfully making other 18-year-old kids do it for years and years and years. Wow. And one thing I noticed though, was as soon as I became what I would call religious or Orthodox, I always thought I was religious before, but not like this, was that I stopped drawing. And my whole life up until that time, I had drawn all the time. Huh. And it was just really interesting to notice that sometimes, you know, hanging on, and again, I think that this gave me context where I could actually help guide people better, both students of mine when I was a rabbi and then as coaching clients. It's like, you got to keep that part of yourself that's real. And if you find yourself making a transition and giving up such a fundamental artistic part of yourself, it's like, again, like the guy that starts working and he stops going to the gym, you're just like, you're screwed. There's no way you're going to be able to do this.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And so your journey of community building through faith and being a rabbi leads you into entrepreneurship, and your entrepreneurial ventures start with leadership coaching yourself and then evolve into public speaking, writing books, and now Business Lift, where I think you're coaching coaches. Tell us about that next chapter in your life.
I mean, at the end of the day, you know, again, it was like saying yes and God at the end of the day. I think that's important, but I started one-on-one coaching. I actually wrote the books before I launched the thing. It didn't get published, but it was important for me to get some of my story out. Same theme, like, you know, a lot of times we learn about inspiring people and we see a very like whitewashed version, but I wanted to talk about all the stuff.
Yeah.
I have to rewrite that book. I'm not rewrite. I have to add the next chapters.
Yeah.
Really what I noticed at the end of the day, which really got me excited about launching my business, is I think that there's an entire industry out there that is trying to strip people of the ability to earn and the ability to help.
Okay, sure.
And with the rise of big education, big government, big, you know, everything, even if you look, and hopefully you're not going to hang me up on the show, like, even if you look at the military and what it was back in World War II and what it is now, when you have these really big organizations and you get people at the top, it takes a couple of years before it's not recognizable. They change like the army's, whatever it is, that their slogans and, you know, kicking out all the operators that wouldn't get the COVID shot. It's just like, you want these men who are like killers to like, you know, and it's like, what are you doing? Sorry, John, I'm stepping on your toes. Tell me what you're thinking.
No, not at all. I agree with you wholeheartedly. When the focus changes from what you originally start out with, you lose some of that. You lose some of that gumption, that some of that defining culture that you're going after in the first place.
Yeah. And then, you know, so taking on a small project like, you know, the government and education. And something I always tell people is like, you know, I think that this is something that will consistently grow. And I think about kind of like a marketplace of ideas. Like now, you know, our lives are so simplified that we can have so much stuff done easily, that if we really focus on monetizing people's expertise and creating a community of people that can help others and then could live abundantly through that, you know, that for me is like, that's ultimately the dream. And if I get to, you know, knock Harvard off the pedestal and, you know, again, cause like this is when I was like, wait a minute, I think there's an opportunity here. My best friend, his wife is a mother of, she's like 38, mother of four, busy woman. And their oldest son had some, you know, challenges. She had a really great therapist or psychologist that helped her. And she's like, I'm going to become a psychologist. You know, I'm going to help other people, which is beautiful and very noble.
Yeah.
So my friend ends up, now they're $120,000 in. She's been in training for 4 years. And at the end of the training, if she's lucky, she'll bill $250 an hour. So people come into my program. It's a little bit above a five-figure investment. I have you making money out of a guy who made 10 grand in the second day of working with me. And I realized like there's just, I think, an opportunity here where, again, if you want to go the route of security and, you know, certifications and, you know, Harvard MBA and like, okay, you know, but again, it's like I spent so much money on coaches. I gave a guy $25,000 for him to talk to me for 30 minutes. I wouldn't recommend doing that with him, but I was committed. But you know, the point is like he had no certification and I didn't care. And so from my perspective, it's like if you're certified, then you're leaning on your laurels. And you know that, John. Like it's like who's the guy who you want is you know, to have your back? Like, do you want the guy who's objectively like the best? Or do you want the guy that everyone says is the best? But he spends all his time garnering all the support. Like the best naturally rises to the top. That's the point, you know?
Yeah.
So that was kind of the idea behind the business. And yeah, it's growing a business. So you get punched in the face a lot, but that's kind of the vision that I have for where I want to take it.
I love that. Well, the fact that you just talked about paying a coach $25,000 for a 30-minute conversation, and people will balk at that and say, oh man, I would never pay money for
what an idiot,
you know,
right?
Whatever amount for a 30-minute conversation.
Right.
However, if I were to tell you that in 30 minutes, I can revolutionize your life so that you'll make a 10X on or a whatever X on that $25,000 investment, then people are going to be like, well, yeah, I'll do that all day. So it's interesting how there's hesitation against a price tag, but what you're not foreseeing is how that time spent is going to revolutionize the rest of your life. And I think that's something I've learned over the past year to year and a half is, you know, when you put a price tag on something, you're looking at the immediate value. You're kind of putting what you had to do to get that amount to spend for that advice. But what you're not thinking about, or what most people aren't thinking about, is time value over the rest of your life and what that speaking into you is going to result in for the future.
And the other thing is like, who else is doing it? Meaning like, you know, at the end of the day, people work with their network. And so like, if your network becomes people that can drop 25K on half an hour, like,
sure,
you're dealing with a bunch of successful people. You know what I'm saying? The reason why, you know, again, I'm sure in companies in the military, like, who was I listening to? I think it was it whoever runs, I think it was Netflix. He was saying like, we're cutthroat in our company because we literally only want the best. And so it's like, you know, the way they've been able to build so dramatically is like they put themselves in a room of people that are very successful. And I think that's something else I also notice is that even if the advice isn't worth it, and again, I think about how much could I make if this goes best case scenario, if it's more than the investment I usually make it. And then, you know, who else is going to be in this room? And that's usually I make the decisions.
It's interesting to hear you say that, Jacob. A lot of people tend to focus on like, oh, the worst case scenario and can talk themselves out. And you sort of think about the best case scenario and what the return on my investment can be from that perspective. So I love hearing that because I don't hear it often enough.
Well, I mean, Steve Jobs says that like everything that exists was in someone's mind. it's a big idea for this upcoming Jewish holiday, which is it talks about how, you know, basically God gave us everything. It's just, we don't know it. And so our journey is just to figure out how great we are. And yeah, it's like the way that you really discover that is you have to be recognized that you're able to do more than you think. And so you have to look at the positive side. But it is an exercise because it doesn't come naturally.
In a world today in need of leadership and mutual support more than ever, what are you most excited about with your business right now?
It's a great question. I think what's exciting is that there is always, the longer you're in the game, the more effective you get at recruiting the right kinds of people. The more you recruit the right kinds of people, the more impact that you can have.
Yeah.
And so the idea that in a small way, maybe a big way, you know, again, there's lots of people out there, we could create that impact of other people getting the help and other people enjoying and doing meaningful work, all the stuff I want to do and getting paid well for it. It's like, that's the dream, you know? And I never tell people, you know, live a life you don't want, but like figure out what life you want and, you know, go for it because you can do it.
Absolutely.
Jacob, we're kind of rounding out the show. We're towards the end of our time, but we always end with a piece of practical advice. So entrepreneur, rabbi, success coach, leadership, you know, advice, what would you give, what piece of information or insight would you give for those contemplating or just starting in their second act? And what would you leave with our audience today?
I think at the end of the days, the real ones will want to help others. And so, you know, and there's a famous idea that it says that more than the calf wants milk, the mother calf wants to nurse. And so there's so many people out there that have already done what you want, that if you figure out what you want and you go ask someone that's done it and you're honest with them and you're genuine, they'll probably talk to you. And then, you know, putting yourself in a position where you're helping others as well who are behind you, like that's the fastest way to be able to create that, let's call it energetic vibration with the people that you want to help you in your own journey.
That's awesome. Jacob, I know you've hung in here like a champ in this episode and we don't want to drag it on any longer for you, but thank you so much for sharing your amazing and very interesting life journey. Definitely not something we've had on the show before. And for listeners who are interested in learning more about your story, as well as those who may want to be in touch, what's the best way for them to find you?
Businesslift.com is the website. Okay. And then on all the socials, except for my TikTok, I'm on TikTok also. Jacob Rupp, R-E-P-P.
Okay. All right.
Awesome.
We'll,
love it.
We'll,
thank you so much, guys. It's such an honor. Really honored.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Jacob, thanks for coming on. And it's good to see you again, man. Have a great rest of the week.
The second act with Michael and John stars Michael Newborn and John Ballinger. The podcast is produced by Seltzer Kings. For more information on the show, check out michaelandjohn.com. Or if you'd like to get involved in the conversation, give the guys a shout on their socials at The Second Act with Michael and John on most platforms. Thanks for listening.
Seltzer Kings.
Podcasts.